Hey, what is up? It's Todd, and in every one of our industries, there's a champion brand that has like sucked all the oxygen out of the industry, and everybody knows who they are, and they're the best, and blah, blah, blah. But most of us, we don't own champion brands, we own challenger brands. So in this episode, I want to talk with you about how to nurture the voice of the underdog, how challenger brands create distinction by thinking culture first.
Discover how video can help you achieve your sales and marketing goals. It all starts right here in Todd Hartley's Video Marketing Mastery.
All right. You know, one of my favorite topics is about branding and how your business can use it to a very distinct advantage, especially if you are an underdog in your industry, in your niche. By the way, just to like pull back the curtain a little bit, I am an underdog in almost everything. I root for underdog teams, except when my team happens to be playing, right? And besides that, like if I see a game, and I always root for the underdog, and I hope that the underdog comes back and wins. And even if the underdog is winning, I switch and start rooting for a comeback from the team you're expecting to win. It's just part of my nature. But in marketing, when you can leverage the force and the power of an underdog brand, you can do some amazing things. And that's why I'm joined right now by two of the co-authors of The Voice of the Underdog, How Challenger Brands Create Distinction by Thinking Culture First. Mike Sullivan and Michael Tuggle are with me. Guys, what is up?
Hey.
Hey, how are you, Todd?
Yeah,
thanks so much for joining me, guys. I think what you've done is you've tapped into something that might be one of these unspokens inside of marketing that I want to bring my audience's attention. Now, as we get started, kind of like Sound of Music, can we start at the very beginning? It feels like a very good place to start. Let's start with Michael Tuggle. What's a challenger brand? Break that down for us.
Well, challenger brands tend to be brands that are in not category leaders, right? Second place, third place, seventh place. Brands that are being vastly outspent. They fighting brands that have a lot more resources probably than they do, usually a lot bigger than they are. And brands that are just trying and hustling as hard as they can to try to compete against the category leaders, but actually outmatched by their resources or even people.
Okay, now it's interesting you say this because, you know, my agency services maybe 100 different companies. Some of them are the gold standard champion of their niche, and others are the underdogs that are trying to thump their chest. But the underdogs, typically when you first meet them, have almost a defeated attitude. Mike Sullivan, isn't this kind of like flipping the script and giving the underdog like the secret playbook to stand up, rise up in their niche and find the distinct advantage that they do have?
Yeah, that's, you know, Todd, that's exactly what it is. And it's interesting that you say that, you know, a lot of the challenges that you meet have sort of a defeated attitude. Some do, you know, it's sort of the poor me. We don't have the resources. We don't have the, you know, the money, the budget, that sort of thing. But many don't, you know, when you look at brands like, you know, Red Bull back in the day when they came into the United States and the way they did that, you know, without spending, you know, traditional advertising and marketing dollars. And they basically created an entire category. A lot of companies just like that. And the other thing that I would say is, you know, I'm a child of Detroit. I grew up in Detroit. And so I watched General Motors behave like a classic category leader ultimately their demise. If category leaders adopt the principles and the philosophies of challenger brand thinking, they wind up much better off too. So it's something that works across the board, and it's the kind of thing that excites us, obviously, as marketers.
Yeah, I like it. It's fun to watch a challenger. Like, I know that going through your material, like Avis was a challenger. Avis is only the number two car rental, so they try harder. They use that to their advantage. For the three of us, we grew up watching the Pepsi challenges. Mm-hmm. Pepsi came out and used its distinct advantage to go head-to-head against Coca-Cola. We are about 36 hours from a presidential debate with a challenger and a what feels like somebody that's leading. And this plays out everywhere in life. As I'm going through your book, one of the things that I found interesting was, as a marketer, how you guys explain challenger brands can't spend their way to success with big ad campaigns like category leaders. Why don't we start with Mike Tuggle? If you could, Michael, tell me about this. Like, why can't a challenger brand just pump money into the process and then rise up?
Well, part of the issue becomes, it's not so much that they can't do it, is that they just don't have it. You know, they just don't have the funds and the resources to do it. But the great equalizer, you know, we found over the years at Loomis, we've always found the great equalizer is good thinking. You know, you can think your way out of a problem a lot faster and easier than you can think you can spend your way out of it, because, you know, money is just a finite resource. You either have it or you don't. Sometimes you can raise it, but a lot of times you just don't. So you're stuck. It's, you know, right? The mother of invention, right? Necessity is mother of invention, right? So, you know, so you got to find a different way to go at it, and thinking your way out of it, coming up with a creative solution to come out of it. And then, as we found too, building the culture to go with that, that it facilitates that, it can make all the difference in the world.
You know what I love is, great. Go ahead, Mike.
If you'd like me to share an example on that, you know, and this is sort of what inspired my entire thinking around challenger branding, you know, more than a decade ago. We had a client that was a retail mattress brand, a chain of stores. They had about 30 stores, and they had really stagnated in growth. And this was sort of the 2009-10 period. So the Great Recession had, you know, just tamped down all discretionary spending. And they were trying to figure out how, not only were they going to continue to thrive, but expand. And, you know, what we found with them was that they had done something from an operational standpoint that none of their competitors had done. And they really created an excellent customer experience. So, you know, that category is just notorious for, you know, it's sort of an upsells kind of a construct. And so people come in and they just want to get you out of there with a mattress, and it's kind of used car-ish. And this chain was doing it very differently. And so what the net effect was, that the return rate was much, much lower for them than it was for their category competitors. And so we went to them and said, hey, why don't you offer an industry first 1-year money back guarantee? And you have to also understand, if you've ever bought a mattress, that, you know, that the return process is so draconian. It's like you've got 30 days and you've got to get it back yourself. And they just throw all these hurdles at customers. Well, this 1-year, you know, no questions asked, return your mattress thing was a huge differentiator for them. And it was only possible because they had operationalized something that was truly different. So it's, you know, the Avis example is a good one. We use it in the book, but it goes well beyond advertising. And it goes back to the way you perform and the way you operate. And for that change, their culture, their company culture, is what allowed them to actually do that and perform that way. And so it created a huge advantage for them, and their sales wound up being, kid you not, up 50% the first month they rolled it out. They sustained that trajectory for the next 3 years, and ultimately grew to 100 plus units and sold the chain.
Love it. What a success story.
Yeah, really.
That's remarkable. Now, Mike Squared, let's come back to the conversation of strategy in just a moment, because something tells me, between the three of us marketing nerds, we all know that the secret is starting off with strategy, putting in that extra time, doing your market research, interviewing the top salespeople. Let's go back to that in just a moment. But while we're talking about the mattress company, their salespeople were trained in a unique way. They were operating like consultants, or as trusted advisors, rather than salespeople. Why was that an essential piece of marketing with an underdog voice?
Well, it was essential for them, and in their case, because it is the one of many things, but one of the most important things that really distinguished the way they operated, the way they showed up, the way they engaged with their customers. You know, much like the way, say, Chick-fil-A, and everybody knows that brand, has prized customer service. It's not so much about the chicken they sell, it's about that experience. And that's what this company did too. They were really focused on creating a fantastic customer experience. So their ratings and reviews and all that stuff was good. And as a result of that, they were able to do something disruptive in the marketplace that their competitors simply couldn't match. And in fact, one competitor, a national chain, did try to match that and had to repeal it like within a month because they were getting covered up with returns. Because again, they hadn't fundamentally operationalized something that would create different. And that goes to culture. You know, it's the kind of people that you hire. It's how you train them. It's, you know, clearly expressing your mission statement, what your vision is, and understanding your values and guiding principles and getting people aligned around those things.
All right. So this for me is particularly an exciting part of the book. I am a big fan of creating a culture where your team is the trusted advisor and not the salespeople that are just hawking products, right? It's a unique difference. It makes people want to do business with them. But the research that you guys did into the mattress firm that became a critically important detail would transition them from a challenger brand into more of like rocket fuel into their growth. Yep. Let's go back to what is typically the very beginning in strategy and how your team extracts that, and how in the book you guys are advising and guiding people to go through that process like a blueprint to determine what is their challenger voice.
Michael, you want to jump on that? Yeah, that was a great session that Michael did a lot of work on.
Yeah, it always starts with just like everything, sitting in a room with people who are informed, you know, with a good strategic direction. And we think about, okay, what would you do differently? Okay, they're just like everybody else. I mean, let's look at it. Let's just say the playing field is even. Everybody's the same. This company's not the same. This company's different. You know, where other companies would, you know, as far as training goes, here, let's do 5 hours of training. Let's do a day of training. These people did dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of hours of training with every single person before they ever put them on the floor. It was a radically different, fundamentally different way of doing business. And so for us to sit down in the conference room trying to figure out, well, how do we do it? We looked at every aspect of their company, every facet of their business, everything that we could look at. And that's when we stumbled upon this. And we were like, this is radically different than what the way everybody else does it. What could we do? What could we build around that that honestly sets them up to succeed? And honestly, at the same time, everybody else is going to fail because they're not set up that way.
Yeah, it fundamentally comes down to really, you know, aligning your business strategy with your people strategy, you know, with your culture that ultimately produces this kind of an effect. So, you know, what business problem are you trying to solve? You know, where are you having problems against competitors? And then, you know, as Michael says, you know, using your imagination to think about an outcome that would fundamentally disrupt or recharacterize the trajectory of your business, and then having the will to actually do that. And that, frankly, is where a lot of companies get hung up. You know, it's like, you know what, well, we could make these changes, but that would mean, it always means sacrifice of some kind. And that sacrifice is painful. But for the companies that are willing to make that kind of sacrifice, it can show up in just incredible marketplace advantage.
And every business, if it wants to be healthy, has to grow. And growth typically comes from making the right sacrifices at the right time. And I find all of this very interesting. And when I go through strategy with a team, I'm typically looking for, when I'm trying to find that, like Mike just mentioned, that unique advantage, I'm typically looking for friction in the buying process. And like, for those that want me to define friction, it's like wherever irritation exists inside of the buying process, it could be just as simple as a form field or like one too many form fields, or it could be too many steps or too much text. But if you can sniff out the friction and understand where your client has that unique frictionless experience, that's also part of helping them lay out an underdog strategy. Am I right, Mike?
You're 100% on. I mean, Todd, I think about our job as, you know, removing the barriers. You know, what are the barriers for the customer? How can we move them along more smoothly? And going back to that example, you know, that's what the CEO of that mattress chain decided he wanted to do. And that was just, you know, make the customer experience smooth and easy, right down to, hey, if you don't like what we're selling you, bring it back, you know, and make that return policy, frankly, as easy as the return policy is at, you know, a lot of, you know, retailers, like, you know, Walmart is got sort of a notoriously easy and smooth return policy. And so in this industry, that was very different. This is another technique that we use with clients too. So what works well, think outside of your industry, what works well in other industries that might be applicable to your industry? One of my favorite mall brands, if you will, is a company called Lush. I don't know if you're familiar with Lush, but they sell these bath bombs and, you know, soaps.
Sure.
Women love, and hey, a lot of men love them too. We buy them for our wives and then we use them. Giving away my secrets here, but Lush is so awesome because what they did is they said, look, we're just selling soap like everybody else, but look at this butcher, produce experience at places like Whole Foods. What if we displayed and organized and sold soap in that way? And so that's a classic overlay. You take something that is cool and people like in one industry, and then you overlay it on yours and to see what it looks like. And what it looks like for Lush is, you know, probably 5x, you know, retail price on the products they sell. You can buy those products anywhere, but, you know, you're going to pay, you know, a lot more there, and people stand in line to do it. Just go there during the holidays.
It's really interesting because this is the reason my wife doesn't want to go shopping with me, because I will approach a display and the next thing I know, my marketing strategy head is on. And then I look for what Mike Sullivan just mentioned, the classic overlay. I actually just call it like the blueprint, but I like classic overlay because it reminds me of like these projection overlays that we would have in school where the teacher would put like an overlay on a projector, right? And then you just lift it up and you lay down this classic overlay into your industry, your clients and variety. And before you know it, you've got that square box that's going into the square hole and you've got one that works. Can we talk about this? Like, one of the cool things about your book is the blueprint. And how should a listener, somebody that's watching now, develop a blueprint for building their own transcendent culture, but also an overlay that they can start using for their products or services?
Oh, jump on it.
It all starts with purpose. I mean, you have to think about, you have to be intentional about it. I remember the first day we started Loomis 22 years ago now, whatever it is. Well, day one, literally, I remember the night we sat in the conference room and decided, what are we going to call this new agency? We sat there and we made an agreement that those of us around the table that we were going to take everything good that we had taken from other agencies where we had worked, and we were going to incorporate that. And we're going to take all the stuff we didn't like, all the bad, all the negative, and we're going to toss it and we're going to find a better way.
It comes back to, you know, identifying what you're going to do and then how you're going to do it. That, you know, the what you're going to do is business strategy. You know, what problem are we solving? What are we offering to the world that the world doesn't have? And if the world has it, how are we going to do it in a way that is distinctive and unique so that they'll want it from us? And then, you know, how are we going to do it? You know, and with whom? And that's where a culture comes in. So it's kind of a what, how, if you will. And there's a lot of work. But
as an entrepreneur, I think we all do this intuitively. We look at things that are wrong in the industry or in a service that we provide, we see in competitors. Yep. And then we make that promise or commitment to ourselves that we won't present our business that way. And it feels like the path to least resistance when trying to determine what a challenger's brand and voice is, one of the ways that would probably bear the most fruit is identifying the customer's path to least resistance inside of when you're going through strategy, determine that the company that is dominating the industry is creating a lot of resistance with their customers without noticing it. And if you can identify that and build that into the culture of the challenger, you've got a real distinct advantage that not only rallies and motivates that internal team and develops that culture, but it also sings the praise of the challenger brand through the marketplace. Is that one of the elements here, guys?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great you know, sort of way to characterize that, Todd. I mean, you look at challenger brands like Whole Foods. Well, what were they challenging? They were challenging the, you know, impersonal transactional nature of the typical grocery store experience. And they built it in such a way that they had their customers in mind. They knew who they were trying to appeal to. And it wasn't everybody like most grocery stores. It was a particular group of people who were obviously plugged in and very concerned with respect to sustainability and environmental causes and very, I call them green, you know, sort of pluralistic sort of characters. And they built a brand just for them. And guess what? When you do that, you do it unapologetically. And you know, we're going to stand for some and not for others. Well, your customer group is going to show up. And yet again, there's Whole Foods, you know, who has just a huge loyal following. I'm included in that. And they're able to charge, you know, prices that reflect that too. So again, when we reflect the values that our consumers hold dear back to them, then our brand becomes a way, frankly, to help them reinforce and support their own sense of identity. You know, I buy the products and services that, you know, reflect the way I feel about myself, you know, and that's fundamental to effective marketing and advertising.
I've got a Whole Foods a mile from my house. It's a big part of my life, and especially pre-COVID, but I have noticed the challenger brand vibe has changed since the Amazon purchase. And now I'm either sensing it or I'm recognizing this in their customers, that the customers are also feeling a disconnect. Mm-hmm. A challenger brand can get disconnected from its mission and its message over time, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Sure. You know, I mean, you think about every company started as a challenger brand at one point. The Whole Foods example is really interesting in that respect too. And and that was a concern when Amazon bought them. And of course, John Mackey, you know, is professed to really be committed to their brand and the way they're doing things. But hey, time will tell. I mean, that's really a good point. But, you know, Chase Bank was a challenger brand at one point, you know, and in the book, I talk about the banking industry too, and what happened with some of the big actors, you know, in the, you know, during the Great Recession. You know, they were all challenger brands at one point. And at some point, you know, some brands lose their way with respect to that and start to think like, you know, category leaders. And hey, there's a lot of advantages, obviously, to being a category leader. You can, years and years ago, I worked on the Ford account in Detroit. And boy, the money that the brand was able to throw at advertising, I mean, good luck, Mini, you know, good luck, you know, some of these other, they just couldn't do it the way Ford did it. You know, ultimately though, that can come home to roost the way it did for, say, General Motors or Dodge, you know, when they're acting like category leaders and not thinking like challengers.
It reminds me, I know this is going to sound strange, but I totally feel this way. It reminds me of the American Revolutionary War, where the British were the strongest force in the world, and the U.S. used challenger tactics in order to be able to win. Michael Tuggle, one of our listeners, one of my followers, is reading your book right now, and last week said, "Oh my God, Todd, stop everything you're doing. You've got to interview Mike and Mike on the challenger topic. Can you do me a favor and talk to my audience and followers on the benefits they would get from going through your book and being able to work on their own brand as they go through it?"
Sure. I think there are two main things that they're going to take from it. The first is a better understanding of what challenger branding really is and the benefits that you can find from being and thinking like a challenger. I mean, it is a distinct advantage to just the mindset, just thinking that way, acting that way, and looking for those advantages. I think they'll find that for sure. And then the second thing is understanding the importance of company culture, both from a standpoint of a business leader, which the book is definitely written toward business leaders, you know, thinking about your own culture, how you grow it, how you sustain it, how you, you know, grow it within the company and how you get all your people on board. But it's also for people actually looking for that culture. There are a lot of people out there who don't run companies who are looking for a fantastic place to work. Yeah. And it's important that they think about company culture as well, and understand that not every great culture is great for every person. You know, there's a point we make in the book that the greatest there's a chapter called "When Great Cultures Aren't Good," and it's, you know, Amazon could be a fantastic culture for somebody who is full of energy and ready to go, and you know, just can't. I mean, they're just all over it. If your speed is more like a Barnes and Noble, which is another great, you know, culture, you just need a little. It just you're not going to necessarily be great in both places. And so I think in the book, you're going to find that challenger branding angle, but you're also going to find, you know, how do you build a great culture, but also how do you find a great culture if that's what you're looking for?
Yeah, that's really a key point. I mean, brands are ultimately driven by people, and people are attracted to and create culture. And brand and culture in that respect are inextricably linked. And I think, you know, anybody, whether you're a company of one or a company of 1,000, you know, it's never too early to start thinking intentionally about culture and the kind of place and business you want to be and the kind of people you want to enlist and attract to help you create the brand that you're developing.
It's so cool to hear you guys say on Friday. By the way, we're recording this. If this ends up in the podcast and you're hearing this at a later date, we're recording this on a Monday, first thing in the morning. But Friday last week, the last activity for our team was a Zoom meeting, a party for the team that we would always have traditionally in our office once a month. And it is our abundance and appreciation event. And what I love about that event is how we go around and talk about the members of the team. And each person goes around and acknowledges people that have gone above and beyond to help them be successful that week. But the thing I loved about it was I forgot that we were having abundance and appreciation party when we were doing the Zoom with our team on Friday, but a junior employee said, would it be okay if I started? And I want to thank, and then the culture kicked in on its own. And what I loved about it was I didn't have to be the host of the culture to watch the culture work and do its appreciation of each other. And when brands get that going, not only does it happen internally, but that vibe of like of serving each other radiates to your clients and their projects. And I know you guys know this because I can see you guys nodding, but that's like a really cool thing to see as it happens organically.
And that's really cool. And speaks well of your company, Todd. You've done a great job. I mean, because it becomes self-reinforcing to the point where junior people find their tribe. It's like, I belong here and I feel safe here. I'm making an important contribution here. And, you know, they come in with a different kind of energy, and it just, it's powerful stuff. And I think this is sort of the next thing that brands are going to really figure out and start to really pay attention to.
Especially when your ad dollars become so much more efficient because people get swept up into the culture and the vibe of that challenger brand. Mike Sullivan, for those that want to get their hands on this book and then leverage the challenger advantage for their business or their clients, where should they go?
Well, they can go to Amazon.com and just, you know, type in the title, or they can certainly go to our website. We've got a little pop-up on our website at theloomisagency.com, and they can get it there too.
And do me a favor, spell Loomis for me.
It's L-O-O-M-I-S. So it's THELLOOMISAGENCY.com.
Beautiful. He's Mike Sullivan and Michael Tuggle. They are co-authors of a book that my followers raised their hand and said, yo, dude, you got to talk to these guys. The book is The Voice of the Underdog, How Challenger Brands Create Distinction by Thinking Culture First. Mike Sullivan and Michael Tuggle, thank you so much for joining me on the Toddcast.
It's a pleasure, Todd.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.